attributed specifically female passive features to the participants of his meetings, and thus also hinted at the role of unconscious homosexuality in mass psychology. Footnote 7. Text. The most important consequences of Freud's introduction of libido into group psychology is that he traits general ascribed to masses lose the deceptively primordial and irreducible character reflected by the arbitrary construct of specific mass or herd instincts. The latter are effects rather than causes. What is peculiar to the masses is, according to Freud, not so much a new quality as the manifestation of old ones usually hidden. From our point of view, we need not attribute so much importance to the appearance of new characteristics. For us, it would be enough to say that in a group, the individual is brought under conditions which allow him to throw off the repressions of his unconscious instincts. Footnote 8, text. This does not only dispense with auxiliary hypotheses ad hoc, but also does justice to the simple fact that those who become submerged in masses are not primitive men, but display primitive attitudes contradictory to their normal rational behavior. Yet, even the most trivial descriptions leave no doubt about the affinity of certain peculiarities of masses to archaic traits. Particular mention should be made here of the potential shortcut from violent emotions to violent actions stressed by all authors on mass psychology, a phenomenon which in Freud's writing and primitive cultures leads to the assumption that the murder of the father of the primary horde is not imaginary but corresponds to prehistoric reality. In terms of dynamic theory, the revival of such traits has to be understood as the result of a conflict. It may also help to explain some of the manifestations of fascist mentality which could hardly be grasped without the assumption of an antagonism between varied psychological forces. One has to think here above all of the psychological categories of destructiveness with which Freud dealt in his Civilization and Its Discontents. As a rebellion against civilization, fascism is not simply the reoccurrence of the archaic, but its reproduction in and by civilization itself. Page 123. It is hardly adequate to define the forces of fascist rebellion simply as powerful id energies which throw off the pressures of the existing social order. Rather than this rebellion borrows its energies partly from other psychological agencies which are pressed into the service of the unconscious. Since the libidinal bond between members of masses is obviously not of an uninhibited sexual nature, the problem arises as to which a psychological mechanism transforms primary sexual energy into feelings which hold masses together. Freud copes with the problem by analyzing the phenomena covered by the terms suggestion and suggestibility. He recognizes suggestion as the shelter or screen concealing love relationship. It is essential that the love relationship behind suggestions remain unconscious. Footnote 9. Freud dwells on the fact that in organized groups such as the army or the church, there is either no mention of love whatsoever between the members, or it is expressed only in a sublimated and indirected way. through the mediation of some religious images in the love of whom the members unite and whose all-embracing love they are supposed to imitate in their attitude toward each other. It seems significant that in today's society, with its artificially integrated fascist masses, reference to love is almost completely excluded. Footnote 10. Text. Hitler shunned the traditional role of the loving father and replaced it entirely by the negative one of threatening authority. The concept of love was relegated to the abstract notion of Germany and seldom mentioned without the epithet of fanatical, through which even this love obtained a ring of hostility and aggressiveness against those not encompassed by it. It is one of the basic tenets of fascist leadership to keep primary libidinal energy on an unconscious level so as to divert its manifestation in a way suitable to political ends. The less an objective ideal such as religious salvation plays a role in mass formation and the more mass manipulation becomes the sole aim, the more thoroughly uninhibited love has to be repressed and molded into obedience. There is too little in the content of fascist ideology that could be loved. The libidinal pattern of fascism and the entire technique of fascist demagogues are authoritarian. This is where the techniques of the demagogue and the hypnotist coincide with the psychological mechanism by which individuals are made to undergo the regressions which reduce them to mere members of a group. Page 124. By the measures that he takes, the hypnotist awakens in the subject a portion of his archaic inheritance, which had also made him compliant towards his parents and which had experienced an individual reanimation in his relation to his father. What is thus awakened is the idea of a paramount and dangerous personality, towards whom only a passive masochistic attitude is possible, to whom one's will has to be surrendered. While to be alone with him, to look him in the face appears as hazardous enterprise. It is only in some such way as this that we can picture the relation of the individual member of the primal horde to the primal father. The uncanny and coercive characteristics of group formation, which are shown in their succession phenomena, may therefore with justice be traced back to the fact of their origin from their primal horde. The leader of the group is still the dreaded primal father. The group still wishes to be governed by the unrestricted force. It has an extreme passion for authority. In Le Bon's phrase, it has a thirst for obedience. The primal father is the group ideal, which governs the ego in the place of the ego ideal. Hypnosis has a good claim to being described as a group of two. There remains, as a definition for succession, a conviction which is not based upon perception and reasoning but upon an erotic tie. Footnote 11. Text. This actually defines the nature and content of fascist propaganda. It is psychologically because of its irrational authoritarian aims, which cannot be attained by means of rational convictions, but only through the skillful awakening of a portion of the subject's archaic inheritance. Fascists' agitation is centered in the idea of the leader, no matter whether he actually leads or is only the mandatory of group interests, because only the psychological image of the leader is apt to reanimate the idea of the all-powerful and threatening primal father. This is the ultimate root of the otherwise enigmatic personalization of fascist propaganda. Its incessant plucking of names in supposedly great men instead of discussing objective causes. The formation of the imagery of an omnipotent and unbridled father figure by far transcending the individual father and therewith apt to be enlarged into a group ego is the only way to promulgate the passive masochistic attitude to whom one's will has to be surrendered, an attitude required of the fascist follower the more his political behavior becomes irreconcilable with his own rational interests as a private person as well as those of the group or class to which he actually belongs. Footnote 12. Text. The follower's reawakened irrationality is, therefore, quite rational from the leader's viewpoint. It necessarily has to be a conviction which is not based upon perception and reasoning, but upon an erratic tie. Page 125. The mechanism which transforms libido into the bond between leader and follower and between the followers themselves is that of identification. A great part of Freud's book is devoted to its analysis. Footnote 13, text. It is impossible to discuss here the very subtle theoretical differentiation, particularly the one between identification and introjection. It should be noted, however, that the late Ernst Simmel, to whom we owe valuable contributions to the psychology of fascism, took up Freud's concept of the ambivalent nature of identification as a derivative of the oral phase of the organization of the libido. Footnote 14, text, and expanded it into an analytic theory of anti-Semitism. We content ourselves with a few observations of the relevancy of the doctrine of identification to fascist propaganda and fascist mentality. It has been observed by several authors and by Erik Hamburger Erikson in particular that the specifically fascist leader type does not seem to be a father figure such as, for instance, the king of former times. The inconsistency of this observation with Freud's theory of the leader as the primal father, however, is only superficial. His discussion of identification may well help us to understand, in terms of subjective dynamics, certain changes which are actually due to objective historical conditions. Identification is the earliest expression of an emotional tie with another person, playing a part in the early history of the Oedipus complex. Footnote 5. Text. It may well be that this pre-Oedipal component of identification helps to bring about the separation of the leader image as that of an all-powerful primal father from the actual father image, since the child's identification with his father as an answer to the Oedipus complex is only a secondary phenomenon. Infantile regression may go beyond this father image and through an anaclitic process reach a more archaic one. Moreover, the primitively narcissistic aspects of identification as an act of devouring, of making the beloved object part of oneself, may provide us with a clue to the fact that the modern leader image sometimes seems to be the enlargement of the subject's own personality, a collective projection of himself, rather than the image of the father whose role during the latter phases of the subject's infancy may well be decreased in present-day society. Footnote 16, text. All these facets call for further clarification. The essential role of narcissism in regard to identifications which are at play in the formation of fascist groups is recognized in Freud's theory of idealization. We see that the object is being treated in the same way as our own ego, so that when we are in love, a considerable amount of narcissistic libido overflows on the object. It is even obvious in many forms of love choice that the object serves as a substitute for some unattained ego ideal of our own. Page 126. We love it on account of the perfection which we have striven to reach for our own ego, in which we should now like to procure in its roundabout way as a means of satisfaction our narcissism. Footnote 17, text. It is precisely this idealization of himself which the fascist leader tries to promote in his followers, and which is helped by the Führer ideology. The people he has to reckon with generally undergo the characteristic modern conflict between a strongly developed rational, self-preserving ego agency, footnote 18, text, and the continuous failure to satisfy their own ego demands. This conflict results in strong narcissistic impulses, which can be observed and satisfied only through idealization as the partial transfer of the narcissistic libido to the object.